This is Shaping Places, the podcast where we meet the people helping to shape the world around us and ask them to reflect on the places that have shaped them. I'm Dave Erasmus, speaker, coach, and thinker, and I enjoy turning big questions into impactful projects for others. I'm joined by my co-host, Matt Mason, Head of Innovation and Skills at the Crown Estate, and together we work with The Conduit on impact and sustainability. Our guest today is Rosanna Vitiello, an urban strategist, cultural researcher, and creative director. She's also co-founder of The Place Bureau, a research, strategy, and design studio dedicated to connecting people with the stories of their environments. From Bournemouth seaside piers to the rollercoaster streets of Naples, Rosanna's perspective blends local identity, cultural storytelling, and global placemaking. Today, we'll explore how she helps cities find their voice, why a cheeky approach matters, and what makes a place feel alive. Welcome.
Thank you. Such a pleasure to be here, genuinely.
I'm really looking forward to it as well. And Matt Mason, how are you doing?
I'm good, thanks, Dave. Also very excited about this. Best part of my week, always is.
Well, let's dig right in. When we think about Shaping Places, the thing we get excited about first is asking, where do you come from? What places have impacted you? So take us back to the beginning of Rosanna and and what started having its way with you.
Yeah, no, it's a great way to put it. So I was born in the UK. I was born by the sea down in Dorset in Bournemouth. And I grew up with a childhood like exploring Dorset, which was fantastic. But my family are primarily from Naples. So I'm three quarters Italian and a quarter Irish. We would spend a lot of time in Naples, you know, when we were kids on both sides of the family. But my dad grew up in Naples. He's born and brought up there. My mum has family there too, and they're from very different parts of the city. So I suppose I had a lot of people in London, you know, an upbringing that is quite mixed in many ways and had a lot of different influences from different types of places.
And do you love Naples? How do you feel?
I mean,
you brought a book with you. You said, oh, I forgot I made a book about Naples. Yeah, I was like, who gets to say that? I mean,
Naples is like a thrill ride, right? If I look back at the memories I have when I was a kid, even through to today, it's still the most intense place I've been, without a doubt. And it's kind of a roller coaster in all the most beautiful, you know, comedic and tragic ways. I'm very, very proudly from Naples and always still fascinated, you know, by it.
I actually had the chance to go to Naples for the first time this year.
Ah.
Didn't have enough time to sort of really dig into the history and learn about it properly, but I could tell I was a part of something that was quite epic.
That's a great way to put it. If you think about even just the natural setting in Naples, right? Mm. It's dramatic. Mm. You can't get away from the fact that that volcano is there. It reminds you every day this could be your last, and so you better enjoy it. And then you have the sun and the Mediterranean and always, you know, always the drama on that side. But then I think the other thing about Naples that's fascinating is the drama that you see play out on the streets. So, you know, there's a shrine on every corner, and not just to a saint, but to someone's mom or to Maradona, of course. Mm. And people really take the streets to be there. So I think I was there in Naples last year, and all the kids who are like literally under 10, like some of them probably even under 5, like riding around on little motorbikes. If you think about the freedom on the one hand that you can have and the kind of cheekiness of that city, you know, it's the rules don't apply. And that's one thing actually I really, really love about it, which is easy to say when you don't live in it. That's another thing. It's easy to kind of be removed from it.
Any similarities with Bournemouth?
There's quite a few, and in a funny way, because on the face of it, it was quite a dramatic difference as a kid. Like I grew up in the place that everybody else went on holiday, and I went on holiday to the place that, especially in the 80s, nobody was going to Naples. Like it was quite a rough time for the city. You know, they had a big drug epidemic. They had one. Maradona caused them to win the Serie A, which is great. So that was a big thing. But as ever, there's always like the high and the low. And so it was going from like the rolling countrysides of hills of Dorset and the sea to the intensity of Naples. But the sea is one of the commonalities there. And I've traveled, you know, to lots of different parts of the world and lived in lots of different places. If I have the sea, that means that, you know, I feel at home. And I think that was a really interesting thing that stuck with me. But there's another element too, I think, actually about the theatricality that I don't think that would be my first impression. But once I started to think about this, I mean, the British seaside in general is actually very theatrical because the weather's normally bad, so we have to figure out how to entertain people, right? And I actually think it's a place where you can be quite fantastic and be very imaginative. Mm. You know, I was thinking about this, that you used to be able to go to the end of the pier in Bournemouth and there was a theatre.
Mm. Wow.
Yeah, on the end of the pier. You know, it's very jazz hands in some ways, a lot of like dance and showmanship. And I see that across a lot of parts of the south of the UK when you get in those tourist resorts. And the same in Naples. There it's theatrical in the streets, for sure. But it also it has a really long tradition of theatre and storytelling. And it goes into people's homes. There's a lot of, you know, artistry there too. And I see that in my family on both sides, whether they were actually professional artists on my mum's side or whether on my dad's side, they were working another job, you know.
Theatricality is a word that's going in my locker. And I also cannot let go. I have to ask the question. I've had a cheeky pint. I've had a cheeky Nando's. What does it mean to be a cheeky city?
I think it comes down to the fact that cheeky is about you lay one thing out and somebody does the opposite. It subverts the truth. Mm. But it's not really causing anyone any harm. And most of the time in Naples, that's what's happening, right? But I think it's this general ability for somebody to play something out to you and you say, I'm not going to accept that. I'm going to turn it on its head. Mm. Look at it now. And for people to kind of make them smile a little bit.
And I guess it can take some time to understand the personality of a city and the sense of humour of a place. How do you, as a teenager travelling from Bournemouth and arriving in Naples, make sense of this dramatic, chaotic Italian city?
That moment of arrival is quite an important point, actually. So I do remember often getting off the plane, you would be hit always by the heat, you know, that difference. And then the smell of like of coffee, of marble, which seems like a weird thing to smell, but it's a sort of dustiness that you have. And then of rubbish, which is also a very, very big problem actually in Naples. So you'd always be hit by that smell. And I think another interesting point in Naples is that most people speak dialect, which is quite different, to be honest, to Italian. So if we grew up in a household speaking Italian and then we went to another city and people are speaking a language that you understand but half understand, it means you've got to tune into a lot of other senses to understand like what the hell is happening. And so I actually think that that was almost great training to go and be in a situation where you don't quite know what's going on. I think I do that a lot nowadays. And you start to pick up innately on other cues and clues, whether there is a visual, whether they are the smell, the texture, and try to piece together some of the stories, you know, of people. And you also start to get good at reading people, you know, reading their gestures and their face, because you can't necessarily see what they're saying. I think the other thing is some of the most incredible places are hidden in neighborhoods that you wouldn't expect. Mm. So to give you an example, my uncle lives in quite a rough area of Naples in the suburbs, San Giovanni. But he lives in the grounds of the palace, which is still occupied by aristocracy, the Prince of Naples. What's interesting is the fact that if you look at it in Naples, that you had Villa Partenopea, villas of the aristocracy that created a kind of built along the coast and then filled in with a sprawl in the 50s. And so you get these really unexpected places in and among, you know, things that you wouldn't expect at all. And so I think that you always have got to go a little deeper, knock on that door and see where you might end up.
So so Naples is a cheeky city that smells of coffee, marble and rubbish.
Yeah.
What's the equivalent for Bournemouth?
I didn't realise how lucky I was to grow up by the beach until I'd left it, right? The beach to me was always offered you a sense of freedom, right? As a kid, also when you're older, it's free, which is incredible in this country. It's not free everywhere by any means. And it's a place that's actually very multicultural down there. It's one of the things, I grew up in a household that had people coming in from all over the world because a lot of people come to Bournemouth to learn English. So we would have students and au pairs and people who were, you know, we never lived in a household with anybody English. Everyone was from all over the place. And the same happens when you go to the beach. I like this fact that on a beach, you can be 5 years old and be a placemaker, right? Because you're there with a bucket and spade. So it became a place of really like incredible freedom.
I love as well that everyone loses their uniform.
Yeah.
You know, no matter whether you're a postman or an aristocrat or where you sit in the hierarchy, that hierarchy somehow gets slightly dissolved or flattened or forgotten at the beach because we're all in our pants.
Yeah.
And we're all jumping in the water. It's fluid, it's flexible.
Yeah.
And
you have to look quite hard to find people's place in the hierarchy, which there's a freedom in that as well.
Well, that, and that's the other thing, actually. It's really nice, your point about the great unknown, is that there's always a sense, I think, of when you grow up by the sea, it changes so much. Like one day, weather's beautiful, it's flat. The next day, there's a storm. You get used to this idea of constant change and of not quite knowing, you know, what's going to come. I actually find that very relaxing. It's the one place I can stop my mind buzzing. And you're quite right, because you can only be yourself, right? When you're at the beach, there's nothing else.
There's nothing else, indeed.
So how did those experiences in Naples and Bournemouth kind of shape what you then chose to do kind of when you grew up, when you left school, when you ventured out into the world of work?
I always wanted to work internationally. I think growing up, you know, with two cultures, it's quite normal to therefore feel like you have, you know, the ability to understand the world in a different way. It's a big world out there. So you know that even when you're a teenager. Because I think the important point is, we were to get from Naples to, sorry, from Bournemouth to Naples, we'd often, in the 80s, drive down. It wasn't so easy. It wasn't so accessible to fly.
Road trips. Part of your identity.
Yeah, exactly. We had an old VW, orange VW.
Awesome.
Which was cool. We'd drive down through France and Germany, Switzerland, and we'd end up down in Naples. So we'd see a lot of incredible things along the way. And so the idea of like looking at places and, again, trying to figure out a culture and what made this place special, when you didn't, I didn't speak any French, I didn't speak any, you know, German, it became quite an important part of that. So I was trying to find a career where I could piece together this ability to travel with an understanding of place, and then also bring in the kind of creative side. And you know, I grew up, as I said, with a creative household. So my dad was an architect. On my mum's side, all her family are artists. She has never drawn anything in her life. She will say she's definitely quite business focused, but she comes from a family of artists. So we grew up with a lot of people who were drawing and thinking about, you know, how to capture a moment.
Do you think that people who are at home at the beach, who have been infused by the beach living, are different to those who live inland?
Yeah, that's a great question. I do. I have a hypothesis about this, and I really love working with coastal communities for that reason. So we did some work last year in the Isle of Wight, in the Bay Area. So a lot of beachside communities there. When you grow up with that sense of freedom and this openness to the unknown, it enables you to be a bit more open-minded, literally. And I also found that they're much more young at heart. So one really fascinating thing about working in the Isle of Wight, which has got quite an aging population, and we worked with some amazing volunteer groups who, you know, were probably 70 plus, but were so energetic in terms of their spirit. So I think there's this ability to tap into your inner child. You never lose that at the beach. And that's really valuable, I think, when you're thinking about the sort of spirit of place and also how to work with people. And I think the same goes for port cities too, which are innately welcoming people from all over the world. Liverpool's a great example. We've done some great work in Liverpool.
A lot of what you've spent your life doing is about understanding places.
Yeah.
You brought in the book about Napoli, and whilst you're out of the room, I said to Dave, this is like the ultimate trying to understand a place. It's getting to the point that you can capture it and put it in a book.
Yeah.
And it feels like what you've described in terms of your journey is sort of touching on all of the different capabilities and skills you need to understand a place, like navigating a place when it's not somewhere that you speak the language. So you can't read signs. You can't, like, how do you read the implicit cues in a place to understand that place? You know, how do you understand the social dynamics, all of these other things? And so it almost feels to me like the start of your career was almost ticking off those, like, I need to understand how to do this and this so that I can really get to grips with place.
Yeah, you're right. And maybe it was always me trying to understand, you know, myself, which we all do, I suppose, to some extent, right? But I think especially if you've got this dynamic of you're spending time in one place, the other, like Naples, is very potent. And I think that happens to a lot of people who, you know, second generation, their parents are often from places that are super intense and culturally often very rich, but economically, you know, challenging. It's often where they left. But it means that culture that gets transported back, that's in your home, the music, the food, etc. For us, it's this the place doesn't just have to exist in the physical sense.
Mm-hmm.
That's quite difficult to say when you're working with a lot of architects and people who are working with, like, you know, hard real estate. Mm-hmm. But it's very true. And if you can capture that sense of culture and establish what that means to people, right, then you're able to create something that's very powerful. And I think actually a lot of our work is about understanding place and then helping people imagine that and visualize that and hold on to that before the actual place is itself devolved, has itself been developed, and we're always trying to sort of share these tools and skills with other people. But I started a project now a long time ago with a colleague of mine, Marcus Wilcox, and he's a senior research fellow at St. Martin's in design for public space. But our project, the Urban Lexicons project, is all about how the city speaks to you and how we speak back. And your points, Matt, about like all of these skills that you're using to pick up on what a place might be. We also had a theory that actually we all have this kind of lexicon, this like vocabulary, right, of our experiences. And again, it's subconscious. We've been to, for instance, I don't know, say you grew up in the mountains, you know how to read, you know, whether something's dangerous or not. You know how to read when the weather is changing. You pick that up based on the experience and you become fluent in that place. If we could understand what those meanings were to people, we could actually build a very powerful sense of also shared meaning and collective identity. We haven't quite cracked how to do that yet, but that's a lifetime's work. And I think that goes back to your point. That's the identity of the city. There's this shared meaning. So if a million people are being cheeky in lots of little gestures and ways, it adds up to something, you know.
But it's special when it sort of emerges and rises naturally rather than being something mandated, because then it's not so deeply organic within the soul of the place. It's just a campaign that someone's put together. But you now call it cheeky, but they've been cheeky for millennia or generations
or
whatever.
Exactly, exactly. And I think that's also, that's an interesting point. Like I put in front of you, you know, a book on Naples, but the reality is that is a city that's a couple of thousand years old. And so it's almost impossible to be able to understand it, which is the interesting thing. That's why it's so fascinating. You keep digging and you're like, oh my God, another layer and another layer. And I think this is also an interesting thing about Dorset. You know, we grew up around the Jurassic coast. Mm. We knew this was millions of years old. Mm. Sense of time in Dorset is another really interesting thing. Mm. And it really does pervade, you know, the place. It's even been turned into brands like Dorset cereal. If you read the back of Dorset cereal, it says, in Dorset, we breakfast on the slow. And like things do happen at a slower pace there. Mm. There's a different sense of time. And that is a cultural norm, you know, that if you can take a much longer look back, why hurry? Right? You know, so it's, I think these, again, they're intangible cultural assets. They're, people do value them, but we need to find ways to all be more perceptive, I think, and be more open to it, you know?
And then moving into kind of the present, maybe you could tell us a little bit about the Place Bureau and the work you do and what your purpose and mission is.
Yeah, so the Place Bureau is a research strategy and design studio. And our aim is to find new frontiers and new futures for places around the world. So all of the work we do is with a lot of different types of people. So whether you are a master planner or a market stall holder or a mayor, you know, we find ways to think creatively with you about what your place is, what it means to you, and where you want it to go in the future. And then we help you out to figure out how to get there.
The work that you and Place Bureau do at the moment, I've been lucky enough to work with you a bit in recent months. It'd be interesting to kind of talk a bit about your work on shaping new and regenerated places and how you ensure the community is at the forefront of that kind of work on creating place.
Yeah, well, I think our work is always focused on building better relationships, right, with place. And so in the way you build a better relationship with place is the way you build a better relationship with anybody. A lot of it is about establishing trust with people as a starting point. But then how do you do that? If you want the community to be involved, you know, you've got to figure out what are you bringing to them and what are you asking of them as well. And we've done it in a lot of different types of places. Probably the best example, actually, most recently has been in Bristol, where we worked with a city council there on a Western Harbour. And one of the challenges in Western Harbour is it had a history where, in essence, it was taken over by the transport engineers who kind of came in, put forward certain proposals that everybody was unhappy with because they ran right through a beloved garden centre. And the council, they needed to refresh the conversation, start again. So what they did is they came to us and said, look, we want to take a more creative approach to understanding place and think about the vision for this place in the future and what it could be. And we worked to hire like five different creative ambassadors. We brought in the city poet, photographers, filmmakers, illustrators to capture the snapshots of, again, this quite gnarly place under flyovers by the dockside that no one could put their finger on, but to highlight the fact that this was important to people. So one of the most interesting things, I think we've got a beautiful photo by the photographer Ibi Ferrer of a lady practicing the clarinet under one of the highways because the acoustics under there is amazing. And so there's a great, you know, group of musicians who go there to practice. This means that this place actually has a significance to people that isn't, again, subversive. It's not necessarily immediately obvious. And what we're doing is using tools like poetry, photography, all these creative artistic tools to be able to reveal it.
I'm so enjoying hearing your relationship with words and concepts and how you use words. I don't want to miss this opportunity to ask the most fundamental question that one could in this topic, which is, how do you define place?
I listened to a great podcast the other day by an Irish poet called Padraig O'Toole. Don't know if anybody ever listens to it. He talked about the fact that places are so much more than what we see. That's the important point. They're so much more than the tangible things that are left there. They are all the elements of culture that come from that. The language that we speak, the smells that we associate with it, the music we listen to, the food we eat, the way we dress, even the way we look sometimes. And I think the idea of place, therefore, is that I can look at a building. In fact, the building we're sat in has probably gone through many different iterations, right? At once, it might have been a warehouse, and then it was, you know, something else, a restaurant, and now it is we're in a podcast studio. So the idea of the buildings, they're honestly the least important thing there. So all place does is place is a container to gather people, right, around a shared sense of what they value. And then to express that in one way or another, of which a building can be one, but there's many other forms that, to be honest, live on much, much more. The food we eat is probably, you know, actually much more powerful in some ways. And in doing so, I think we're also able to share that with others. So an important part of place, I think, actually, is it should be shared. And I think as the world is becoming more multicultural, that's going to become, you know, more and more the case.
I think one of my kind of key takeaways from this conversation I want to reinforce is that what you build is not the place. It's almost everything else. Like when Rosanna described Napoli at the beginning, it's the volcano and it's the smell of coffee and marble and rubbish. Neither of those things are what was built there. It's almost what was already there in the context of the beach and the mountains and everything that is around the place. And then what happens in what was built that creates the smells and the noises and the community and the culture and everything else. How I think you can ruin a place by building the wrong thing, but I think it's hard to make a place purely by building something. So the work that the Crown Estate has been doing with Place Bureau in Hemel Hempstead is we're developing new residential communities in the east of Hemel Hempstead. So building houses that will exist in new places. How do we make sure that we don't, A, build the wrong thing, but more importantly, that there is a community there, that there is the right kind of activities, that the place has an identity that people can connect to, and we are creating a place, not just a built environment.
And I think that that's one of the things that we genuinely appreciate about working with you is that it, you know, Crown Estate people take a really holistic view, but the other element is the time frame. You know, and when we worked together on East Hemel, we helped you set a vision for 100 years and ask that question and say, if you had 100 years to design or to shape a place, how would you think differently? And going back to the point around relationship building and trust, it's a bit like saying, right, we're in this for life. You know, it's commitment from the outset. And that's, unfortunately, that's very rare in places to find sort of people who are able to kind of steward for the long term.
One last question, just to indulge in this 101 on the, both places and making and shaping. Yeah. Can you speak to what makes a good place?
Yeah, okay, that's interesting. Look at, let's say, you'd always get those kind of lists of like top cities in the world, the Genevas and the Zurichs and the Stockholms and places that feel where life is good. Mm. And then you get the alternative cities. So a couple of years ago, we wrote a report actually about rebel cities, which were the, you know, those places that you might have overlooked or might have a bad rep. And for sure, Naples had a terrible reputation, and rightly so, you know, in the 80s, but that just have that kind of quality that you fall in love with because you're a little bit fascinated. It's actually just like, you know, watching a movie and falling in love with a character who's like a flawed, you know, flawed hero. It's the same thing. So I think there is a need to enable some places to like leave a little roughness around the edges when you make them. And I think you've always got to look at that element of what could it offer to me that is exciting, that I, where I can feel like I can reciprocate because there's a little bit of a mirror to me and that also will ultimately care for me, right? That's the important point.
I also think it's a really relevant and topical challenge right now for the UK at a time when we're going to build 1.5 million new homes in the country over the next few years. A majority of those homes are going to be in new places.
Mm-hmm.
And how do we make sure that those places are great places, but with identity? Mm-hmm. And does our planning system allow for us to create cheeky towns that smell of coffee and marble?
I think maybe what's quite empowering about what you're saying, in all the land of 100-year thinking and planning for 1.5 million homes, and it's what could I do today that maybe I'm being a part of making this place good, whatever this place may be, rather than getting too worried about all the technicals and all the... We need all that too.
Yeah.
But also we can do something to be a place shaper or placemaker
exactly.
or part of the solution today.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great point, is that all of us have the capacity to be placemakers, right? Mm. And those small gestures that somebody puts in, someone plants some flowers around a, you know, a tree, or a market stall holder gives you, you know, I don't know, a free falafel, or set something out so it's enticing and you can look at it. And all of these gestures make a difference. And to be honest, I think within the realities of this big planning system where it and world, right, where it feels the whole world is kind of going turbulent times, we're headed sort of out of control, being able to show that sense of care and get it back, I think is really important. Mm. How you can build places that might encourage that, invite you to do that, I think is important. And I think that was actually one of the interesting things also about the beach and about Naples, is going back to them as a point, is like they are places where people take over totally, if you think about it. So what could we do as architects, or, you know, commissioning places, to put those invitations in and not just give permission, but say, hey, like, this is free, you know, go for it. And also accept that sometimes it goes wrong. That's a reality, right?
Yeah.
That's a reality.
Absolutely. I think we're sort of coming into land. I wonder if you'd be willing to paint us a bit of a picture. You know, imagine all the resources under the sun. What does an ideal kind of future in Rosanna's world feel like?
Great question. Great question. We're working on a concept right now between the UK and Karachi in Pakistan, looking at a digital museum of coastal futures.
Mm.
And one of the things I love about it is its ability to connect people, coastal dwellers around the world, through their understanding of the coastline.
Mm.
And to do so by thinking about how we can create digital places that would support our understanding of sharing knowledge. So on the, that's a little bit of a sidetrack, but my point is, there are great digital tools at our disposal to help everybody get involved and start to build this collective picture of, like, if a million people put forward their idea for a place, or put forward their perspective on a place, what would we find from that shared identity? We've never been able to do that really before.
So, kind of crowdsourcing placemaking in that sense.
I think on the one hand, using that. So on the one hand, using that kind of deep, fast-paced evolution of technology. And on the other hand, what we're seeing emergent is a real shift in, at least in the West, in our understanding of the natural world, right? And then what we need to do is work out how to kind of bring them together in, let's say, a more social world, like literally face to face. And I think we need to do that through finding some better structures that are ongoing and are committed in terms of how we build that relationship. So at the moment, for instance, I'll ask you for an idea and then I'll see you later. And then what we want to do is to create something that's much more regular, basically, and have, you know, that ongoing conversation with people that they're like, oh yeah, they're back. Okay. Like next week, they're back again. And it, and we can all become place literate, right? And all have a say in our place if it becomes, you know, a part of what we do. Some of that might be there should be place in the curriculum. You know, some of that might be there should be place assemblies that we're all a part of and we all kind of care for. But you've got to make them fun. And so we've created a collective place futures toolkit. And the intention is to enable groups of people to get together, whether that's you and your neighbors on your street, or whether that is your own mayor in a city, and you're trying to gather, you know, groups of citizens and stakeholders. The rules are the same, basically. It's set up as a toolkit, again, in that sense of openness and freedom, that I don't think there's one standard set of rules that should be followed. If anything, it's a little bit gamified in its approach. It does follow like a four-part approach and kind of pattern, but you have the freedom to choose which tools you feel are appropriate based on the challenges you're facing, the questions you're asking. And we're looking always for places that want to try this out.
Well, that's brilliant. And we'll get the links in below. Where are the best couple of places for people to find you and your work?
Oh, we've got a pretty active Substack. You can read about all of our actually research in natural futures, which is up there right now. And we'll always be posting dispatches from different parts of the world. Should be some coming up next year from Mexico, as an example. You can head to our website. There's plenty on theplacebureau.com. Yeah, you can also check out on LinkedIn, but I'll always kick you back to Substack in general anyway. That's all good.
It's an amazing, rich conversation, Rosanna. You're incredibly articulate and clearly done a huge amount of amazing work. And I personally really appreciate hearing from you today, learning from you, and getting the brain juices flowing. And I can't wait till our next conversation.
Cheers, guys. Thank you.
Thanks very much. See you next time on Shaping Places. Thanks for listening to Shaping Places from The Conduit and The Crown Estate. If you've enjoyed the conversation, follow the show wherever you get your podcasts. For any links or resources mentioned today, check the show notes in your podcast app. I'm Dave Erasmus with Matt Mason, and we record at The Conduit in London. Until next time, take care of yourselves and look after each other.